So Psalm 52 begins with one of these little historical notes at the top. That is our verse 1, even if it's sometimes in a bit smaller print. It's there, you know, in the inspired word of God. So it's good to always read those bits anyway, and often they'll give us a little bit of background to the situation in the psalm. So Psalm 52 starts in verse 1 with this: "To the chief musician, a contemplation of David, when Doeg the Edomite went and told Saul and said to him, David has gone to the house of Ahimelech." So it told the situation. I wonder if any of you off the top of your head, maybe a little bit of head scratching to try and remember if you've heard of Doeg before. Doeg the Edomite and what this situation might be that he's talking about in this. So we'll pause Psalm 52 for a minute and we'll go in search of some of the answers to the background of it. So if you turn back to 1 Samuel, we're going to pick up, I'm going to read a couple of little verses, then Anne is going to come and read a little bit for us as well. So just to try and get a little bit of the story of Doeg and David. I've got a few pictures here if the children wanted to look at them as well. So you know the story of David and how he used to be a shepherd, looked after the sheep and so on. And then God sent Samuel to him and David was told he was going to become the next king. He was anointed and then very famous story of him going to fight Goliath. And after that he came into Saul, who was the king, his royal court. He was a leader in the army. He seems to have been, you know, almost sort of adopted into the royal family and would sit there at the royal table and things like that. It was an important person in the nation of Israel. But as time went on, Saul became more and more resentful and angry towards David. And several times he tried to kill him. A couple of times he just tried to, you know, just got out of control with anger and tried to hurl a spear at David. But God kept him safe. Now these things were getting worse. And David was pretty convinced that these weren't just angry outbursts from Saul, but this was a determined effort on Saul's part to kill him. David was also good friends with Jonathan, the king's son. He's the one in yellow there who's being shouted at by King Saul. And Jonathan said to David, "Well, I'll try and find out. I'll go to this feast. I'll try and find out what my dad is really planning." And so he did. He went to this feast, and there was another angry outburst from Saul. And in 1 Samuel chapter 20, we read in verse 31, this is part of Saul's rant almost: "For as long as the son of Jesse," that's David, "lives on the earth, you, Jonathan, shall not be established, nor shall your kingdom. Therefore send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die." And Jonathan said to Saul his father and said to him, "Why should he be killed? What has he done?" And then Saul cast a spear at Jonathan to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. So there's this outburst at this feast, and Jonathan sort of stands up for David and says, "Look, he hasn't done anything wrong." But Saul shouts at Jonathan, tries to even kill Jonathan. But Jonathan heads out from that occasion, and he knows now, he tells David, "Yes, my dad has really got it in for you. My dad is trying to kill you. You can't come back into the royal court anymore. You know, those things are, they're long gone. You're going to have to run away." And so David does that, and Anne is going to read for us the next bit of the story in 1 Samuel chapter 21. Anne's going to read the first 9 verses for us here. Great, thanks. So David flees from Saul and he goes to this town, and there we presume is where the tabernacle might be. It's a little bit hazy because exactly the location of the tabernacle at this time. But anyway, it seems to be here in this place. It may be that the ark wasn't actually there. That seems to be said somewhere else. But anyway, so there's the priests are here in this town, and there's the tabernacle. And David goes there. His men are waiting somewhere else, it seems. And he meets the priest. And the priest's name is Ahimelech. And we're told that when he sees David coming, he's a little bit nervous about this. Maybe he's a little bit suspicious why David should be on his own. Maybe Ahimelech, you know, has an inclination that something's not all, you know, all good in what's happening here. And David comes to him. He's on the run from King Saul, and he lies to him. David doesn't tell Ahimelech the truth that he's running away from King Saul, but instead he says he's on a secret mission for King Saul. Maybe he's deliberately trying to keep him in the dark so Ahimelech's not put in trouble. It might be that kind of thing that sort of motivates him to do that. And in the end, Ahimelech agrees to help, and he gives David some of the bread, the special bread that was there in the tabernacle. And that was given to feed David and his men. And David also asks to borrow a weapon. The only weapon they had there was a sword that once had belonged to Goliath. Going back to the beginning of David's story. And so he borrows that sword from the tabernacle, from Ahimelech the priest. But there's a little note in it. We were looking out for that name, weren't we? Doeg. And he's there in verse 7, isn't he? One of the servants of Saul was there on that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg, an Edomite, chief of the herdsmen or shepherds who worked for Saul. And he's there. And on David goes in the verses that follow. David goes to the Philistines first of all, and then he goes and hides in a cave. And then in chapter 22, he goes to hide in a forest instead in Judah. And in the end, Saul finds out. And we'll read the next little bit in a minute. But first of all, we'll pause and sing where we got to just before. So David's on the run from King Saul. And he's gone to hide in a forest in the end. And Saul finds out about this. That's what happens in that verse where Jill began. In verse 6, Saul discovers where David and his men are hiding. And Saul straight away is the one who's accusing, isn't he? He accuses all the men of plotting against him. He accuses them all of being on David's side. And so on. You might have noticed he was sitting there with a spear in his hand. So noticeably, everyone's very nervous of him because this isn't the first time he's thrown that spear at somebody. Now, it's a very difficult situation. Saul becomes increasingly paranoid, and he completely turns the tables on things as well, doesn't he? He's the one who says that David's lying in wait for him. That was in verse 8, wasn't it? But of course, that's not true, is it? David's actually trying to avoid him. He's trying to hide from him and so on, isn't he? And yet he turns it all round that everyone's against him, that there's a big conspiracy against him. And so that's the situation that's going on. And it seems, you know, everyone's very nervous around Saul. And then, verse 9, Doeg, the chap we're trying to keep an eye on. Doeg the Edomite's the one who speaks up. And he's very quick to point the finger, isn't he? He points the finger. Yes, there is somebody who we could blame in all of this. I saw David, he went to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest. And there he is, accusing Ahimelech straight away. He accuses Ahimelech of inquiring of the Lord for David, giving him provisions, food, and giving him Goliath's sword. Of those three things, we don't actually hear of Ahimelech inquiring of the Lord for him. But the other two definitely happen. But Doeg carefully tells this sort of mixture, doesn't he? He tells him a little bit of truth and maybe a little bit added to it. And he keeps a little bit taken away as well, doesn't he? He doesn't say, and if he was there the whole time listening to the conversation, he knew that David had kept Ahimelech in the dark. But Doeg doesn't say that. So with his mixture of truths and additions and omissions, he blames Ahimelech and puts the spotlight on him. And so Ahimelech is summoned in, and he comes very politely, it seems, before the king. Verse 12, none the wiser about what might be happening. And Saul says in verse 13, you're part of this conspiracy against me. You and the son of Jesse are in cahoots. You're the one who's planning my assassination or something like that. And this is what you've done. And Ahimelech protests. And says in verse 15, did I begin to inquire of the Lord of him? No, far be it from me. Nor let the king impute anything to his servant, to any in the house of my father, for your servant knew nothing of this. Ahimelech protests that he was completely in the dark. David came, he assumed David was on this secret mission. He helped David, he didn't have a clue about what was happening at all. And he points out, and David's always been going on your missions. You know, that was an assumption that it was sensible to make. David hadn't been banished as an outlaw. There'd been nothing like that. As far as anyone else knew in the country, he was still King Saul's trusted military leader. But Saul, of course, sees red. You know, he seems all too quick to turn the sword on Ahimelech. And he orders him to be executed. Verse 16, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." Well, again, we might scratch our heads at that moment. What's the rest of his father's house done? Ahimelech was the one who did these things, and yes, he did them not knowing the situation. But Saul orders for the entire family to be executed. And he again gives his command to his guards, verse 17, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord." Puts that in there, that phrase, doesn't it? At that point, because their hand is with David. They're on David's side. They're against me. But the guards hesitate. The guards refuse. It's a pretty noble thing to do. It could also get them in a lot of trouble, couldn't it? They hesitate to kill the priests of God, even on the orders here of this king. But Doeg doesn't. Doeg has no such a conscience that sort of troubles him. The king says to Doeg, verse 18, "You turn and kill the priests." And so he did. And he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. 85 priests, though the ephod was what a priest wore. It might also be sort of highlighting perhaps the fact that they were unarmed. They wore the linen ephod. It was like a little apron kind of thing that they wore. And they were the servants of God. They worked in the tabernacle. They didn't have any military weapons. They didn't carry swords or anything like that. And so perhaps this sort of phrase that he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod is sort of reinforcing the fact that they were unarmed. Civilians. Servants of God. And yet they're killed. With the sword. And then it seems to just blow up even more out of all proportions. So not just the one man, Ahimelech, who's the person who's initially in trouble, but his whole family, 85 others, are killed too. And then verse 19, he attacked the city of Nob. And men and women, children and infants, oxen, donkeys and sheep were killed with the sword. Now it's just developed into a bloodbath, hasn't it? A massacre. On Saul's orders, no doubt, Doeg then goes back to this place and in this massacre kills men and women, children, babies, even animals there in this town are killed in this place. And then those verses we're reading, one escapes. One priest escapes, one of Ahimelech's sons, Abiathar, and he goes to see David and he tells him what's happened. And apart from that, no one else escapes. And David says, "I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I've caused the death of all the people in your father's house." David's distraught. He hears the news of this bloodbath, this massacre, this horrific violence that happens. 85 priests, maybe hundreds of others, are killed in this place. It's horrible, isn't it? And he hears the news from the one person who escapes. And you can imagine David just falling down to his knees, can't you, in this situation. He feels partly to blame, doesn't he? He says, I saw him there that day I was on the run. I saw Doeg the Edomite there. I knew there was a chance he would tell Saul. It's kind of my fault this happened. Well, he was partly to blame in a sense. You know, Saul was gunning for David. By David asking Ahimelech for help, he put Ahimelech in the crosshairs, didn't he? And that kind of thing. And it wasn't David who killed them, but it was Saul who gave the order. And it was Doeg who did the killing. And it seems then, at this time, David wrote this psalm. So turn to Psalm 52. Now we're ready to begin. Don't worry, it's only a short psalm, you see, but we needed quite a this little psalm, but with a lengthy introduction. And we'll look today at this psalm, and it's good to read, I guess, what's the background to it, because I'm giving it the title, A Psalm in the Face of Tragedy. That kind of fits, you know, once you hear that story of what's happening, what this little clue of Doeg the Edomite, and the story that's there in David's mind, perhaps it is that occasion when he hears this news that, you know, you can imagine him dropping down to his knees, and oh, just distraught at this horrible news that he's heard. And maybe it was on reflection later on he wrote then this psalm. And it's there in the face of that kind of tragedy, isn't it? And perhaps it's a good psalm to sort of bear in mind. It may be the kind of psalm that sort of fits sometimes in particular circumstances, doesn't it? A couple of weeks ago, it was the Holocaust Memorial Day, wasn't it? What kind of psalm, what kind of things do you think about in the Bible in the light of that kind of tragedy, that kind of bloodshed, that kind of inhumanity? Where do we turn? And a psalm like this is a place to do it, to reflect upon it. We see here in this psalm, we're just going to draw out three simple little things. We see here, first of all, the boast of the wicked. And David thinks of these characters in it, and he may be talking about Doeg, or maybe Saul. You know, he starts in verse 1, "Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man?" Maybe he's thinking of Saul. As we said in the story, Saul's the one who gives the orders, isn't it? Saul's the one who's driven by such suspicion and hatred of David that it then develops into this sort of consuming paranoia, the believing everyone out to get him. He's no longer thinking about the truth and what's false. He's just completely overwhelmed, isn't he? In the darkness of his mind. He's the one who gives the orders. Doeg's the one who's so quick, isn't he, to lash out with the sword. And he's the one, it seems, who just doesn't stop. He just kills one priest and then one more. Oh, it just goes on in this horrifying way. David starts in this verse, you know, "Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man?" The word "mighty man," David uses a couple of other times to talk about heroes. It's used, you know, as a kind of term in the army. There were the mighty men. And they were the ones, perhaps, with all the medals on their chests. Those ones who'd been, you know, heroes in times of battle in the past. But here you can almost hear a bit of contempt in David's voice, a bit of sarcasm in it. David says, you know, "Why do you boast in evil, you mighty man?" What did he do that was mighty? What did he do that was heroic? He killed innocent people. He killed unarmed, defenseless priests. He then went on to kill women and children in a town, even slaughtering animals. Is he a mighty man? Well, maybe. Maybe he got promoted. Maybe he went up in the leagues in Saul's army. Maybe he, you know, strutted about thinking he was such a great hero who had done Saul's bidding. Was it mighty? Was it heroic what he did? "No, you boast in evil," says David. That's what you do, you're boasting. Maybe he did go and brag about it afterwards, about all that he did, boasting in evil. What a warped conscience he had, that it seems he no longer had any remorse about his actions, but went on bragging about his deeds in all this killing he was involved in. David says in verse 3, "You love evil more than good." That's what it was. He loved evil. He was an evil man. He loved evil. He loved the violence. He loved the cruelty of what happened. It was there. And here we see some words written thousands of years ago, and yet they're very modern, aren't they? Very relevant, aren't they? In situations we see in the news and around the world, when we hear of murderers, people being convicted of crimes and how they've gone on a killing spree or something like that. We hear stories in some of the cities, in our own country and in other places of the world, in America, down in Colombia and places like that in South America, where there's such drug gangs and cartels and so on, and people can be just shot. I mean, in the daylight, just out in town, in a marketplace, there'll be a drive-by shooting, and innocent women and children and so on will be killed. We see it in the acts of terrorists and in evil regimes around the world and back through history. Those who boast in evil, those who love evil. And here we see it told us, you know, just here in black and white, to spell out for us the brutality of human nature. David also concentrates quite a bit on their words, which is an interesting thing. Because you know, you might think perhaps the focus would be on the violence and on the bloodshed, but actually in verse 2 he talks more about their tongues, their words. Verse 2, your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor working deceitfully. Verse 3, second half, lying, you love lying rather than speaking righteousness. You love devouring words, you deceitful tongue. David reflects on their words, on their tongues that work destruction and work deceit. Again, we said we're not entirely sure what he's talking about. The evil man he has in mind is Saul or Doeg. And actually, these phrases fit both of them, don't they? You think of Saul and how he lies, how he loved lying rather than speaking righteousness. He never told the truth. He never says, I'm the one who's out to get Saul. David. He said, David's the one who's out to kill me. David's lying in wait to kill me. He was deceiving in his words. He sort of twisted things round to portray himself as the victim here and the innocent one and the like. That's the cunning word, isn't it? Like a razor, just sort of cutting here and there, deceiving in his words. And Saul's the one who gives those devouring words. Verse 4, you love devouring words. And certainly Saul's words have to be that. It says, you turn and kill the priests. They were devouring words, weren't they? They were words that were going to lead to death. Words that would devour. As for Doeg, I say the verses fit him as well, don't they? He had a tongue that devised destruction. I wonder if it was on his mind when he saw what was going on with David and Ahimelech, and he went back on his way to Saul, and then when the opportunity comes up, he's got it all ready, hasn't he, to say. And as we said, he says a bit of the truth and leaves some bits out and puts an extra bit in. You know, he just twists things so carefully. He knew what would happen, didn't he? He knew what kind of man Saul was, and he offers up Ahimelech, doesn't he? Saul wants revenge, he wants blood, he wants somebody to pay, somebody to suffer. And Doeg is very quick to point the finger, to twist the words, to lead to that man's death. That's what we see here in these reflected upon in this psalm. And we see it, don't we, you know, back in history and things like that. People's tongue, you know, somebody like Hitler, and even before all the violence began and things like that, and the concentration camps and things, now we register, people look back and see it was there in his tongue all along. It was there in his words. It was there in his anger and his speeches, the way he would twist things and so on. And so it is, isn't it, around the world. So often violence actually is not often done by the people in charge. Often there'll be these powerful gang leaders and people, terrorists and the like, and they, with their words, recruit others to do their bidding, don't they? There'll be these false teachers peddling these ideas to poor people in prison and this, that and the other, and trying to radicalise them into all kinds of things, twisting their words and using other people. And why did Doeg and Saul do it? Well, they're after David, aren't they? Saul wants David. He wants to kill David. And when he couldn't catch David, he kills the priest instead. They weren't his enemies. They weren't even supporting David. It didn't make any sense. But sometimes we see that, don't we, in the persecuted church. There can be sometimes such a hatred for God. But can they attack God? Can they hurt God? Well, no, they'll turn instead on innocent people. They'll turn against the weakest people. Those are so far down in society anyway, and attack them instead. Have them as the scapegoats of those things. But God knows what happens, doesn't he? God knew what happened on this occasion. He knew his priests who'd been put to death, his faithful servants, no doubt many of them were. Just like when Saul, in the New Testament, is attacking the church. And Jesus comes and says to him, "Why, Saul, are you persecuting me?" He was attacking God's people. But God knew what was happening all the time in those things. But here we have this honest portrayal of the boast of the wicked. And it rings true, doesn't it? It's such a warning for us. You know, it's that way of darkness we were thinking about in John. And that's where it heads. Through a conscience that gets so twisted and so seared that it ends up being capable of such wickedness like this. The second thing we notice is God's justice, the justice of the Lord. Perhaps David, as he writes this psalm, thought about the fact that what justice would there be? What could David do? He's on the run. Anyone who comes into contact with him is made a target. What can David do? Saul was the king. Doeg was one of his henchmen. They were untouchable, weren't they? Could anyone bring justice against them? The bereaved families of these priests? Anyone who survived the massacre in that town? Could anyone do anything about Saul and his injustice? Doeg and his violence? Well, here we see the justice of the Lord. And in verse 5, we have four views. God shall likewise destroy you forever. He shall take you away and pluck you out of your dwelling place and uproot you from the land of the living. David spells it out, these four yous, that God will destroy them, take them away, pluck them up and uproot them. David knew there would be justice. As you imagine him down on his knees, weeping for this horrible event that happened, he knew there would be justice in the end. Whether it would happen in this life, he doesn't say, but it will definitely happen in the end. And the phrase at the end, he'll uproot you from the land of the living, seems to suggest that, doesn't it? That in the end, God will take them out of the land of the living. We're told, aren't we, in the New Testament, it's appointed for man to die once and face judgment. It was appointed for Saul. It was appointed for Doeg that God would take them out of the land of the living. And they would face judgment. They would face justice for what they had done. When that would happen, we don't know. We only know the situation of the death of Saul. Doeg's never mentioned again. For Saul, his death came quite unexpectedly. So a little bit like again in the New Testament of those words that Jesus said about the rich farmer in one of his parables, and how this very night your soul is required of you. It would come at some point. Doeg's life would come to an end. Saul's life would come to an end. And they would meet God. And they would face a justice. They'd be taken out of the land of the living. And there would be justice. God will destroy them. Here it is in the Old Testament. There was a couple of verses this morning, didn't we, of the words of the Lord Jesus in Matthew, and how he warned about the punishment that comes for sin. We might think of Saul and Doeg here being these horrible sinners who murdered people and did such horrific things. But we're told all of us will die and face judgment. We'll come back to that in a little bit. In the justice of the Lord, we're told then in verse 6, the righteous will see and fear and laugh. It's It's a funny thing to say, isn't it? The righteous will see it. Perhaps there would be those who survived it and who were traumatized by all the things that happened. They'll see what happens in the end. They'll see the justice of the Lord. They'll see and fear. They'll fear God and laugh. Laugh is a strange word to put in at this point, isn't it? In this psalm, in the face of tragedy. It seems an unkind thing to say, even, doesn't it, of a villain like Saul and Doeg, that people will laugh at his death and his demise. But it's not a laugh of joking about it or finding any sort of pleasure in it. We're told in God's word, God doesn't take pleasure in the death of the wicked. And so David's clearly not talking about that, that somehow it's going to be a funny joke that's very amusing. And God's people don't either. We do find out when Saul does die that David weeps. David weeps for Saul. Even, say, the part he played in this massacre and things like that. David weeps when he dies. But in another sense, perhaps it's a sort of a grim laugh, if you know what I mean. Perhaps it is to sort of reinforce when the righteous will laugh with that fear of God, it had just before that in verse 6, and with a fear of God, there's a sort of laugh of, well, look, there is justice. Maybe it's especially because they don't have the last laugh. There will be justice in the end. A little bit like Psalm 2. When in Psalm 2 and verse 4, there's people who come against God and the one in heaven laughs. Again, not a funny joke, not anything like that, but there's a sort of a grim laugh of, look, there'll be justice in the end. There's nothing you can do. There's nothing you'll get away with before God's bar of justice. And what is it that they laugh? Verse 7, here is the man who did not make God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of riches and strengthened himself in wickedness. They'll reflect when people like Saul and Doeg are taken away and their life ends and they'll face judgment. And they'll say they didn't trust in God and his strength, but they trusted in riches and they trusted in wickedness. Now there'll be justice. Lastly then, there's the hope of God's people. The hope of God's people. David, as he reflects on this horrible situation, he can find hope and comfort in God. We too will all face God's judgment. It was appointed for David to die. At some point too, it is appointed for us to die. And whether we may not have been quite such criminals and done such barbaric things as Doeg and Saul did, we'll one day face God's judgment. How can we escape destruction? In verse 5, David pictures somebody being uprooted, a plant being ripped out of the ground. And yet in verse 8, he thinks of a green olive tree that's been planted and that's growing. How can we not be uprooted? How can we not be destroyed? How will we survive God's justice? Well, we're told a couple of hints back here in the psalm. Verse 6, he talks about the man who didn't make God his strength. Well, that's the answer, isn't it? That's what we must do. Make God your strength. Make God your strength. So often, these men of violence and evil, they're so proud, aren't they, of their strength. They boast in those things, their violence and so on. Yeah, we see it, don't we, around the world, people boasting. We see that in the Ukraine, isn't it? A lot of boasting that's going on. People lining up their armies and saying, my army's bigger than yours, and the like. There's that kind of rivalry and so on, to try and show off this sort of human strength. We're told as Christians, make God your strength. Make God your strength. Back in verse 1, even in the midst of those depressing verses, boasting in evil, oh mighty man, the goodness of God endures continually. That's what we need to know. That's how we can find comfort, even in difficult situations. God's goodness endures continually. It lasts. David knew it. Even when he heard that horrible news, God is still good. God's goodness endures. And whose side do you want to be on? Whose side do you want to be on? Humans desire power. And through aggression and violence and lies, they put their strength, their trust in riches and wickedness. And instead, in the face of all of that, there's God's goodness that endures forever. And David said, that's where I'm going to put my hope. That's where I'm going to put my hope. In God's goodness. The world, oh, it's such a mess. But I trust in God's goodness. Verse 8, I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. Trust in God's mercy. And so that's David's reflection upon these things. That's how we can escape destruction when the time comes for our appointed time to die. If we're trusting in God's strength, his goodness that endures, his mercy that lasts forever, that's where we find those things at the cross, don't we? Where strength and goodness and mercy come together to save us, to forgive us from the punishment that we deserve, that we might be spared destruction and instead given life. And David, just to finish, says, I'm like a green olive tree in the house of God. I'm there before God, close to God, in his house, flourishing, growing, green. I'm like a tree God's planted and God's looking after me and God's keeping me safe. And I know I'll be there in the house of God. It might also have a future element to it as well. I'm going to stay in the house of God, a little bit like Psalm 23 and so on. It's interesting, in the New Testament, in the new heavens and the new earth, right at the end of Revelation, it pictures trees that are there in the city of Jerusalem by the river. And in Revelation, they're trees that leaves bring healing. And maybe that sort of fits with this kind of idea here as well, that there's healing in God's house. I'm like a green olive tree in the house of God, and there's healing near him. Healing too for a troubled world in the end, when God will create a new heaven and a new earth, the home of righteousness. And when all of those wrongs will be put right, and people who've come from this old world full of brokenness and having experienced heartbreaks and tragedies, there'll be healing there in the house of God. And so he finishes, I will praise you forever because you've done it. You've made me grow in the house of God. And in the presence of your saints, I'll wait on your name, for it is good. In this dark and depressing chapter that we've been reading in 1 Samuel, David reflects on it and he says, I'll wait on your name. I'll wait on you. Your name, everything about you, God, is good. That's what David's hope. I'm going to wait. Maybe there's a hint in that, you know, why do you let these things happen, Lord? How long will these things happen for? I'm going to wait, he says. But I know that you're good. You're good. Your goodness endures continually. Your mercy lasts forever. And I'm going to make God my strength. Perhaps as we reflect, perhaps as we have different situations personally, or maybe we reflect on situations around the world, hopefully this psalm too can bring us hope, even in the face of tragedy.